This is a lecture on respiration. It's how we exchange gases every minute of our lives, and we do this our entire lives. Let's review some basics. Gas exchange really is ultimately serving another process, and that other process is the process of energy conversion, which we've talked about in a previous lecture when we talked about cellular respiration, and that is converting glucose into ATP. And here's your equation that you've learned. Glucose plus oxygen gives carbon dioxide, water, and ATP. So it's simply an energy conversion process. Now, if we continue to review the basics, we see that this energy conversion process happens in every cell, and the location is in the cytoplasm and the mitochondria. And the metabolic pathways that are involved, there's three of them: glycolysis, the Krebs cycle, electron transport, and oxidative phosphorylation. And if you look at my illustration here, you will see that when we go from glucose to pyruvate, remember that, we get a couple of ATPs. We don't need oxygen for that, right? That happens in the cytoplasm. But if we then take the pyruvate into the mitochondria, we can go through the Krebs cycle. And in the Krebs cycle, we produce a little ATP, but a bunch of NADH and FADH2. And then finally, that NADH and FADH2 can be processed in the electron transport chain. And the final electron acceptor is oxygen. And as a result, you know, we convert a lot of ADP into ATP. Okay? Now, remember that the gas molecule that drives the entire process is oxygen. And it's here in my picture. It's the ultimate electron acceptor in the electronic transport chain, and it combines with a couple of hydrogens, and it makes water. So, and also the gas molecule that's produced during the breakdown of the 6-carbon glucose molecule is carbon dioxide. And, you know, as you kind of rip glucose apart, those carbons end up becoming carbon dioxide, and there's two places that it really occurs. One is in, you know, what I call the bridge, where you go from pyruvate to acetylcoenzyme A, you make a little CO2. And then the Krebs cycle, as it turns around, you make some more CO2. So that's kind of where everything happens. Now let's do a quick overview of gas exchange in animals. The key challenge for most animals is you want to move oxygen in the environment, that's out in the environment, into every cell of the body, and you want to remove carbon dioxide from the cells and return it to the environment, right? That's what you want to do if you're an animal. What you need in order to do this is you need some kind of respiratory surface or system that will help move the gases into or out of the system, and then you need a circulatory system to help transport those gases once you've moved them into or out of the system. So in my picture here, real simple, oxygen can be in the air or water. It doesn't need to be just air. And then it needs to somehow get across some respiratory surface, and it enters a circulatory system of some kind, and that circulatory system will take it to a cell, and then the oxygen is moved into the cell. Meanwhile, the CO2 moves out of the cell into the circulatory system, and then the circulatory system transports the CO2 to the respiratory surface, where it then moves out of the organism into the environment, which could be either air or water. Now, how gases move across membranes. The ultimate reasons gas will move across membranes is due to diffusion. And remember, we've talked about this before. Diffusion is the movement of molecules from a high concentration to a lower concentration. And what drives this is the kinetic energy of the molecules. If molecules have kinetic energy, and they have kinetic energy, as long as something's not at absolute zero, it's got kinetic energy. We can't see it, but the molecules are actually jiggling, moving around, okay? And then they'll just simply move through basic physical processes from high to low concentration. That's what we call diffusion. Now, two things will facilitate this process for oxygen and carbon dioxide. A moist surface helps it do this, and lots of surface area. So if you're an organism, you're going to want to have these two things. So let's take a look at this. Animals will use a variety of strategies to increase the surface area for gas exchange. And so if you look at my picture here, you'll see that we've got gills. Or we don't have gills, but organisms have gills. And so you can see I have a picture of a salamander. Salamander's an amphibian. It lives part of its life in water, part in a terrestrial environment. And you can see that it has external gills. And the gills have, you know, obviously they have a lot of folds. This increases the surface area. And they're also moist. So those are the things that help facilitate this. And they're moist because generally this is going on in water. Lungs and tracheal system. Also, before I move on, if you look in the lower picture, you'll see internal gills that this is a lobster that a lobster has. And so you can have external or internal gills. And that's for exchange in water. And then when you're in a terrestrial environment, you have lungs or a tracheal system, and that's for gas exchange in air. And as you can see, the mammal here, which is a rabbit, has a set of lungs, and you can see the lungs are really great because they're inside the organism, and this prevents the movement, the loss of, it allows you to have a moist surface because you're outside in the air, but the actual surface where the movement of gas occurs is inside the body of the organism, inside the lungs. And that way, the lungs can become moist. And also, you can see that the lungs are divided up into, there's a lot of surface area in the lungs. And also, if you're an insect, you don't have lungs, but you have a tracheal system, which is different, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. But it's also internal. So the bottom line here is if you are a terrestrial organism, the place where you do your gas exchange is somehow inside your body because you want to make sure that it's moist. And it's also divided up into greater surface area. Okay, fish are really interesting. Fish use gills to increase their surface area. Now, this may surprise some of you, but oxygen gas is dissolved in water. Kind of interesting. You know, we usually think of the atmosphere as having oxygen, which it does. About 20% of the atmosphere is oxygen. But it turns out that oxygen is also dissolved in water because any organism that lives in the water, an aquatic organism, if they live in the oceans or they live in fresh water, they need oxygen too. So there is oxygen in water. And they can extract it from the water. And they, you know, fish do this with gills. And gills increase the surface area so gas exchange can occur more easily. And they have a really cool system. It's called a counter current exchange system. And the way it works is very interesting. The blood flows in the opposite direction that the water flows. And if you look at the picture I have here, here's a fish. The water actually flows in through the mouth and then out across the gills. And if you look at a blow-up of a gill, which I've got here, you'll see the oxygen-poor blood flows in on the back side of the gill. Then it goes into the capillary bed, moving forward. And then it goes out of the gill, at the front end of the gill, full of oxygen. And so we call it countercurrent because the water goes from left to right, the blood goes from right to left. So they go against one another. And this maintains a concentration gradient between the water and the blood, because what drives diffusion is a difference in concentration. And that's the important thing to remember, that it's all about diffusion. So as long as you have some kind of concentration gradient, you're going to get good flow, you know, good movement of the gas. And so let me give you a comparison. If you have a non-countercurrent flow, and that would be illustrated over here, like on my bottom illustration, on the far right, there's a non-countercurrent flow. And in a non-countercurrent flow, the blood and the water flow in the same direction. And if you do that, the most The best you can do is you can have 50% of your oxygen exchange. In other words, 50% of it never gets extracted from the water. It stays in the water. If you have a countercurrent flow where they flow in opposite directions, 80% of the water, or excuse me, 80% of the oxygen in the water can move into the blood system of the fish. That's huge, really huge. This is a question that you can sometimes see on the AP exam. They like asking this, so you might want to make a note about that. They love this question because it ties a bunch of stuff together. It ties the idea of diffusion together with a large organism, biology here, fish respiration. So you might want to just make a note of that, kind of study that before the AP exam. Now, insects use a different system. It's called a tracheal system. Here's a grasshopper. They don't take oxygen in to a lung like we do. They have these little things on the side of their abdomen called spiracles. And these spiracles lead into what are called trachea. And the trachea will then literally bathe all the body cells with oxygen. And so it's a completely different way of moving oxygen into the system. Now, this is interesting to a lot of my students. A lot of them don't know this until they hear this. Birds have a one-way lung. And the reason why is because birds have a very high metabolic rate. They're warm-blooded like we are, and they use a lot of energy. So they need to be converting glucose to ATP all the time. And the way they do that is they always have oxygen in their lungs at all times. Here's how it works. Air comes in, it goes down their trachea, and then it goes into this posterior air sac. Some of it goes to the lungs, then you've got interior air sacs. And so during inhalation, the air sacs are filling and the lungs are filling. During exhalation, the air from the lungs and the interior air sac will leave, but even though the air is leaving, all the air from the posterior air sac is being pushed up into the lungs. So even though it's exhaling the bad air, the used up air, it's getting new air, and it's not actually physically inhaling. Do you know what I'm saying? So it always gets a constant source of fresh oxygen at all times. So it's a very cool, evolved system. Okay, let's look at our lungs, mammalian lungs. I'm going to follow, first of all, just the path. How does air get into our lungs? Here's what it does. Air begins in the oral cavity, and then it goes back to the pharynx, which is at the back of our oral cavity. And then it goes down, and remember the epiglottis that covers the passageway down to the lungs? If the epiglottis is up, then the air can go down, and the first place it enters is called the larynx. That's the most upper part of this part of the system, and it's where the vocal cords are. And so very important part, obviously, of the system. Then it drops down into our neck, and you have these C-shaped pieces of cartilage, and it's called the trachea, and it keeps the trachea open when you take breaths. And then down when it gets to the lung, you split into two bronchi. The singular would be bronchus. And then you further divide those into bronchioles. Can you say bronchioles for me? Good. And then finally, the last division of the system is these blind, sort of like cul-de-sacs, in a sense, called alveoli. Can you say alveoli? Yeah, so the alveoli are the very end of the system. And if you look here, here's a cross-section of an alveoli, and you'll see that there are sort of these, I don't know, they look like a bunch of little spheres. And if you do a cross-section, you'll see that they're completely surrounded by capillaries, and that's where the gas exchange occurs, right, in the alveoli. And the nice thing about the alveoli is because there's so many of them, it increases the surface area enormously. Okay, ventilation. How does ventilation work? Well, first of all, let's talk about inhalation. Before I talk about inhalation, let me just remind you, the human body has two main cavities. The upper cavity, as you look at me, the upper cavity contains basically the heart and the lungs, and it's called the thoracic cavity. Then there's a muscle that basically goes across your entire body. It's called the diaphragm. And everything below the diaphragm, this area is called the abdominal cavity. So there's two cavities, an upper and a lower cavity, thoracic and abdominal, separated by this muscle called the diaphragm. What the diaphragm does is when it can, normally it's sort of a dome. So imagine a dome, okay? That's its normal shape. When the diaphragm contracts, it's a muscle, right? When it contracts, the dome, it literally pulls down and flattens out. And by pulling down, it creates a negative pressure in the thoracic cavity. And by producing a negative pressure in the thoracic cavity, it causes the lungs to open up, to get big, and by getting big, that sucks air into the lungs. Okay? That's called inhalation. Now, exhalation is the exact opposite. So now imagine your diaphragm is pretty much flat now, and what your diaphragm does is it relaxes. When it relaxes, it sort of goes back to its dome shape. So it starts to go up. That creates a positive pressure in your thoracic cavity, which then causes your lungs to squeeze and it pushes air out of your lungs. Okay? So that's how the process of breathing occurs. Now, let's talk about atmospheric pressure. This is actually pretty interesting. Does anyone know what creates atmospheric pressure? Ultimately, what's the ultimate creator of atmospheric pressure? Why do we even have why do we have an atmosphere around the Earth? I'll give you a hint. The moon has no atmosphere. The Earth does. What's the difference between the moon and the Earth? Yeah, gravity. It's all about gravity. Mass attracts mass, right? That's gravity. So the Earth is so massive that the mass of the gas, nitrogen and oxygen, basically the Earth holds on to that mass and doesn't let it escape out into space. Whereas the moon isn't massive enough, so any atmosphere that would start to, any gases that would be there would just, they're not going to be tugged on strongly enough, and so they'll just go out into space. But the Earth has got enough mass that it will hold on to the gases. And it turns out that 79% of the Earth's atmosphere is nitrogen and 21% is oxygen. The nitrogen in our atmosphere is, we can't do anything with. It's N2. You know, it's funny, each time we take a breath, we take in about 80% is nitrogen, and we do absolutely nothing with it. It doesn't react with anything in our body. We don't use it. It just goes in, and then it goes out. The stuff that's important is the basically 20% of oxygen. That's what we really care about when we take a breath. Now, the pressure of the atmosphere can be measured, and there's different ways of measuring it, but sort of the common way that we've come to, you know, talk about is it's measured by the ability to raise mercury. And at sea level, it can hold mercury at about 760 millimeters of mercury, now, which is 76 centimeters, which is just under a meter. Now, let me kind of give you a visual on this. You would never do this in class. I would never do this because it's completely and totally dangerous because mercury is not good for you. But if I could, here's what I would do. I get a tube that is a meter long, a clear tube, that I could fill, you know, I just fill it up with mercury. And then I'd have another sort of container full of mercury. I take this tube full of mercury, I put my hand over the top of it, and then I turn it upside down and stick my hand in the mercury container and then remove my hand, and the mercury that's in this tube would fall down until roughly it was 76 centimeters above the surface of the Mercury. Does that make sense? Okay. So why is it doing that? Can anyone explain to me? Why doesn't the Mercury fall any further? Why does it fall just to 76 centimeters? What's going on here? Yeah. That's right. Because the atmosphere is being pulled by gravity, and it provides a pressure on the surface of the Mercury that's equal to the pressure that's exerted by the Mercury itself. And when they're in equilibrium, the Mercury won't move. And it works out when you're at sea level on a normal average day, the Mercury will be about 760 millimeters of Mercury. That's how high it'll be. Now, on days like today when there's some rain, it's a little stormy, then the atmospheric pressure goes down a little bit. So you'll notice that it drops under 760 millimeters of mercury. And when that happens, you can say, hey, a low pressure region, you know, we're getting some low pressure, which means a storm might be coming in. And then sometimes you see the mercury get a little bit higher, which means there's a little bit greater pressure, and that means it's going to be nice, it's going to be really clear, okay? So that's kind of interesting, just to kind of know that basics. Now, just a fun little factoid for you guys. If we wanted to do the same thing, but we wanted to do it with water, what would we need? Well, just think about it. How's water different than mercury? They're both liquids, but what's the difference? Yeah. Yeah, we would actually say it's less dense. So if you're going to make a water barometer to measure water, you know, the pressure of the atmosphere with water, what would you have to do? So I kind of want to give you a visual on this. It's kind of interesting. Yeah. You'd have to have a much longer tube. I think it's around 30-something feet. You know, so if you could get like a 40-foot tube of water and then, you know, flip it over, then you could have a water barometer. It'd be kind of cool. And so that's why they use mercury, because mercury is the densest, easiest to get, material that's liquid at room temperature. Okay, but it's also nasty. Okay, we talk about the partial pressure of oxygen, and what that is real simple. It's if you take the percentage of oxygen in the atmosphere and you multiply it by the pressure of the atmosphere, which is 760 millimeters of mercury, you come up with a number about 160 millimeters of mercury. So what that says is that of the 760 millimeters of pressure provided by the atmosphere, 160 millimeters of mercury pressure is due to the oxygen. And the rest is pretty much due to what? Nitrogen, yeah. But we just care about oxygen because that's what we want to talk about today. So, next slide. The key idea is that gases will always diffuse from a region of higher partial pressure to a region of lower partial pressure, the same idea we talked about earlier. Therefore, the higher the partial pressure, the more oxygen you will transfer to your tissues. Okay, so let's take a look at the next slide. Altitude and oxygen partial pressure. This is a cool slide. If you go to the top of Everest, the partial pressure of oxygen is 50 millimeters of mercury. And that is why they call it the death zone. Now remember, if you look at my picture here, I've got a nice little illustration. If you look down at the bottom, you'll see at sea level, the partial pressure of oxygen, let's just round it, 160 millimeters of mercury. You go to the top of Everest, which is like 6 miles up, right? Okay? And you go 6 miles up vertically, it turns out that the pressure is basically one-third of what it is at sea level. Well, that means it's harder to drive the oxygen from your lungs into your blood, right? And so it's going to be harder to get that oxygen to your tissues because it's just not going to diffuse very easily. Whereas at sea level, hey, you know, it's way better. Now, turns out that body tissues are dying if you're up at Everest, up at the upper reaches of Everest, because they're not receiving sufficient oxygen. Did anybody ever read Into Thin Air by John Krakauer? Anyone read that book? No one in this class. Okay. I highly recommend it. If you want to read just a riveting account of what it's like to climb Everest and what can go wrong, read John Krakauer's book. You know, maybe during Christmas break when you have a little time. It is just, you won't be able to put it down. It's a fantastic book. And he talks about being in, quote unquote, the death zone and what it feels like. And I was very fortunate. The book is about a catastrophe that happened, I think it was 1996, where a whole group of people died. It was a terrible storm that came in one day on Everest, and all these people died. And John Krakauer happened to be on the mountain at the time, which is amazing because he's an amazing writer, and he happened to experience the whole thing. And so he wrote about it. Turns out that I have a friend who was on the mountain that day and helped in the rescue efforts. He was up at Camp 3, which is, Camp 4 is the final camp before you make the summit, and he was at Camp 3, and so he actually helped bring one of the guys down, this physician from Dallas, Texas, who they actually thought had died. And so he's a friend of mine, so he came in the year after that and talked to my AP Bio class and kind of went through what it's like to climb Everest and what it's like to not have very much oxygen. And he did a really interesting exercise where he started everyone off. He said, okay, everyone get up, do, you know, a minute of jumping jacks, okay? And everyone's like, he goes, that's what it feels like when you're just sitting at base camp. Base camp's around 18,000 feet. By the way, the top of Everest is about 30,000 feet. So at base camp, you're like, you know, like you're doing jumping. And that's all the time. And then he sort of works our way up to, you know, camp one, camp two, camp three. And he has people doing jumping jacks and closing one nostril and then closing their mouth. And then finally at the very end, you know, he's got people doing like 2 minutes of jumping jacks, closing your mouth and closing one nostril and trying to breathe through one nostril. And he goes, that's what it's like if you're at camp four. And that's what it's like all the time. You're just like, you just can't get enough oxygen. You're craving it. You're breathing really fast and really heavily. And so it really gave a vivid illustration of what it's like to be in that situation. So I highly recommend the book. Okay. Well, in our next slide, we see that oxygen isn't very soluble in water. So that's a bummer because our circulatory system is a good percentage of it is just water, right? So what has to happen is there's a transportation problem. So evolution has solved this problem by we've got these cells called red cells, red blood cells, and all they are, it's real simple, guys. They have no mitochondria. They have no nucleus. They are just packed full of a protein called hemoglobin. And hemoglobin has one purpose in its existence, and that is to carry oxygen around. And just to remind you, hemoglobin is a quaternary protein, which is really like four tertiary proteins all bound together, as you can see in my picture here. And each, at the center of each of these tertiary proteins is what's called a heme group. And at the center of each heme group is an iron atom. So every molecule of hemoglobin can carry 1, 2, 3, 4 molecules of oxygen. So it is very good at doing this. And that's why we need iron in our diet. Yeah. Well, that's a good point. You know, why don't we just have proteins, the hemoglobin proteins just floating around? And I'm not sure why, except there, you know, evolution, there must be some reason. Maybe our blood would be too viscous if you had all these proteins. And so by packing them in a cell, it makes it less viscous. I'm not sure. Yeah, so it can flow easier, exactly. But that's a great question. How hemoglobin helps. I want to talk about the idea of cooperativity. And just a minute, okay? The idea of cooperativity is demonstrated here in my illustration from the textbook. And it's the idea is that when a substrate binds at one site on a quaternary protein, all the other subunits become active and bind more easily to other substrates. So if you look here on the left, it's, you know, not so easy to bind. So finally, the substrate, of course, is oxygen. It binds in to one of the, you know, one of the hemoglobin sites, and that makes it easier for the other sites to bind. And that's how it works. And I don't, you know, I could have included a couple of more slides in this lecture that show oxygen curves, and I think they're in your book, and I didn't do that. But it's worth looking at because those curves show you how oxygen, as you bind one oxygen, it's easier to bind the second, third, and fourth oxygen in your hemoglobin. Okay, let's talk about control of breathing. Breathing is controlled in two places in your brain stem. The brain stem, if you look at my picture, is the most primitive part of your brain. We call it like the reptilian brain, right? And the part down here, the most primitive, is the medulla oblongata, and then just above it is an area called the pons. And you have breathing control centers in both of these areas. Can you guys all say medulla oblongata? Yeah, that's good. How does it work? Well, it turns out that this is where your breathing is controlled, but where are the detectors located? Well, it turns out that the detectors are located in three locations. One detector is actually in the medulla. One detector is in the aorta, which is, you know, right, the artery that leads your heart. And then there are detectors in your carotid arteries, which go up to your brain. And there, what would you think they would be detecting? Okay, what do you think? Just think. I mean, just what would your knee-jerk response be? What are they probably detecting? What do you think? Say it. Oxygen. Guess what? They don't. Okay? It turns out that they detect carbon dioxide. Very interesting. So, and it turns out that of these three detectors, the most important is the one in the medulla, but the aorta and the carotid artery detectors are important. Now, it's always paradoxical and confusing to my students since they think these detectors should detect O2, right? Because, you know, obviously that's what you should detect. But if you think about it, carbon dioxide is a byproduct of cellular respiration, so it's just as good an indicator as oxygen. Yeah, I'm not sure the evolutionary reason, but it's the way it's evolved. And so as carbon dioxide levels increase in the blood, the carbon dioxide combines with water, forming carbonic acid. This lowers the pH of the blood, right? When you become more acidic, your pH goes down from like 7 to 6 to 5, you know, whatever, just a little bit lower, a little more acidic. So it's not, it doesn't go down to like 1 or 2. It just gets slightly more acidic. And the response to lower pH is what really drives the system. The breathing control center, which is in the medulla, responds to a lower pH by sending signals, and you can see in my illustration, there's nerves that go to the diaphragm and the muscles in the ribs, and it causes them to start to contract more frequently, and that will cause the lungs to basically get rid of CO2 and take in O2. Okay, just a second. Remember, the aorta and the carotid arteries also have sensors, and these sensors will detect a change in pH levels and send that information up to the breathing control centers in the pons and the medulla. And what's interesting is that they also respond to really low oxygen levels, like, you know, when you're at the top of Everest, and to stimulate faster and deeper breathing. So, you know, they do respond once again to CO2, increased CO2, but these guys also do respond to low oxygen levels as well. And the entire system, you should remember, is under homeostatic control. Because, you know, you don't want to breathe too fast, you don't want to breathe too slow, you want to keep it just right. And it's all kind of a feedback thing.